Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro-Libertate Radio, a full-throttle, no-holds-barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gregg.
On July 4th, 1902, President Theodore Roosevelt proclaimed the U.S. war in the Philippines over except for disturbances in the Muslim areas. In 1905, the Imperial Cruise, and I'm reading, by the way, from the book entitled The Imperial Cruise, A Secret History of Empire and War by James Bradley, author of many other notable books, including Flags of Our Fathers. In 1905, the Imperial Cruise steamed into the port city of Zamboanga, a Muslim enclave 516 miles south of Manila. Princess Alice, that was the oldest offspring of Teddy Roosevelt, the only one he had by way of his first wife, sipped punch under a hot tropical sun as Big Bill Taft delivered a florid speech extolling the benefits of the American way. A century later, I ventured into Zamboanga and learned that the local Muslims hadn't taken Taft's message to heart. Zamboangan officials feared for my safety because I was an American and would not allow me to venture out of my hotel without an armed police escort. The city looked peaceable enough to me, and I thought the Zamboangan police's concern was overdone. One morning, I was sitting in the back seat of a chauffeured car with my plainclothes police escort as we drove by City Hall. The handsome old wooden building had once been the headquarters of the American military. The U.S. General Black Jack Pershing had ruled local Muslims from a desk there, and the grassy shaded park across the street was named after him. "Can we stop?" I asked the driver, who pulled to the curb. I got out of the car alone to take pictures, thinking I was safe in front of City Hall. After all, here I was in the busy downtown area in broad daylight with mothers and their strollers nearby in a park named after an American. My bodyguard thought otherwise. He jumped out of the car, his darting eyes scanning pedestrians, cars, windows, and rooftops, and his right hand hovered over the pistol at his side. It was the same later, indoors at Zamboanga's largest mall. I was shopping for men's trousers, looking through the racks. I glanced up to see my bodyguard with his back to me eyeing the milling crowd. The Zamboangan police probably breathed a sigh of relief when I eventually left town. Muslim terrorists struck Zamboanga the day after I departed. Two powerful bombs maimed 26 people, brought down buildings, blew up cars, severed electrical lines, and plunged the city into darkness and fear. The first bomb had cratered a sidewalk on whose cement I had recently trod, while the second one collapsed a hotel next door to Zamboanga's police station, just down the street from the mall I had judged safe. Police sources told reporters the blasts were intended to divert Filipino and American Army troops from their manhunt of an important Muslim insurgent. Just as President Teddy was declaring victory in 1902, the U.S. military had been opening a new full-scale offensive against Muslim insurgents in the southern Philippines. Pacifying Zamboanga had been one of the goals of that offensive. A century later, American troops were still fighting near that pacified town. That empire works until empire destroys itself. If we don't repudiate empire, eventually empire will prove to be a self-nullifying condition. There comes a point of diminishing returns, and I believe it was Niall Ferguson, the British historian who teaches at Harvard University, who just pointed out a couple of weeks ago at a function at the Aspen Institute of all the unlikely venues, that the point of no return and the point at which an empire reaches an incurable critical mass of corruption and fiscal overstretch occurs when it can no longer finance the military. Let me think here. When the military budget eclipses the gross domestic or the payments on the debt, on the gross domestic and public debt. And that's the point at which Rome collapsed. That's the point at which the British Empire collapsed. And America apparently is going to reach that point sometime around 2017. And if I'm not mistaken, that's the point at which the empire is finally and irrevocably done, is when you finally reach that point of financial overstretch. And couple that with what was said just a couple of weeks ago by I'm not even going to try to pronounce his name, the Chinese official in charge of that government's government-run credit agency, to the effect that the indebtedness, the public debt of the United States really is badly overvalued, and we're essentially dependent on China's subsidies to maintain our military. It's pretty clear that the empire is not long for this world. Let me see if I can find the specific statement by Niall Ferguson. Niall Ferguson said the collapse may come within the next 2 years. That's from his keynote address to the 2010 Aspen Ideas Festival. In fiscal terms, continued Ferguson, Washington is very near the edge of chaos. And we've seen in Greece what happens when the bond market loses faith in your fiscal policy. Once again, the bond market, of course, is affected by, among other things, the sort of talking out of school candor that was displayed by this Chinese official with respect to the market value of U.S. government debt. He thinks that Moody's and the other credit rating agencies are deferring to the reputation of the United States. The so-called full faith and credit of the United States is a reflection of our power. And of course, our power is bought with a credit card that the Chinese banks have given our government. And at some point, they're going to have to be paying, the people in Washington, they're going to have to be paying much higher rates of interest, or they're going to have to monetize the debt, or both. To continue here with what Niall Ferguson had to say, both the Soviet and Roman empires experienced a sudden collapse when the cost of servicing debt exceeded the government's military budget. That's a much more concise way of putting it than I had put it previously. Once again, Soviet and Roman empires experienced a sudden collapse when the cost of servicing debt exceeded the government's military budget. That has not been the case, I think, at any point in U.S. history, Ferguson pointed out. It will be the case in the next 5 years. I think he overstates our economic health. I don't know by what metric he would be making the prediction that we have 5 years. Of course, if it happens before 2012, that's within the five-year time horizon that he has specified here. Ferguson also pointed out that Americans are the redcoats now. Think about that for a second. And it all began really with the Philippines. It began with the Philippines, it began with Cuba, with Puerto Rico, it began with that stupid exercise in sanctimonious aggression called the Spanish-American War. William Graham Sumner, wonderful free market economist and old school liberal in this context defined as somebody who considers liberty to be the highest political value, put it very well in the aftermath of that completely unjustified war, that his patriotism was of the kind that was offended to think that the United States of America had never been a great nation before it had knocked the stuffing out of that poor, decrepit old state called Spain. Or as Yoda would put it, wars do not make one great. The greatness of our country is not measured by the wars that it has fought on flimsy pretexts or completely invented pretexts. It's not measured by the graveyards our government has filled or the souls it has sent into the next world under circumstances that simply don't justify violence. It's not measured by the megatonnage and throwaweight of its nuclear arsenal. The greatness of our country is not a function of its power projection. The greatness of our country has to do with the potential that it represents in terms of emancipating individual human beings to fulfill the measure of their creation. That's the greatness of America. The greatness of America resides in the indomitable will for liberty that was expressed by patriots of the 18th century who took up arms against the government ruling them. I've come to the conclusion that the only conceivable way you can justify war is if you're fighting the government ruling you. I really don't think that you can frame the question in a way that makes moral sense if you're fighting a war that is a government enterprise, because all you're going to be doing is aggrandizing the power of the worst elements in your society. I honestly can't think of a war that was fought as a government enterprise that didn't represent a net subtraction from actual liberty. Oh, We're always told about the horrible things that would happen if the other side had won. And horrible things, indeed, would ensue if the other side would have won. But that doesn't mean that what happened is the lesser evil. Lesser evilism is a moral fallacy, I believe. The lesser evil is the evil that is undone, that is hypothetical. The greater evil is the evil that is done. Yes, Nazism was a horrible evil. Imperial Japanese tyranny was a horrible evil. So was Hiroshima. So was the Pact of Joseph Stalin that resulted in all kinds of mass murder and tyranny. Perhaps we'll talk about that on the other side of the break. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. We'll be back in just a minute, so please stick around. Internet is a large-scale version of the committees of correspondence that led to the first American Revolution, and with Washington's failings now so obvious and awful, it may lead to another. That's the opening line of an essay from Investor's Business Daily, yesterday's edition, I believe, entitled, Will Washington's Failures Lead to Second American Revolution? By Ernest T. Christian and Gary Robbins. The authors, I'm assuming there's a bio here, are described as follows. Christian, an attorney, was a deputy assistant secretary of the Treasury of the Ford administration. Robbins, an economist, served at the Treasury Department in the Reagan administration. So these are two people, I believe, not untainted by partisan considerations. So take that into consideration as I continue to read from their essay. People are asking, is the government doing us more harm than good? Should we change what it does and the way it does it? Pruning the power of government begins with the imperial presidency. Okay, let's stop here for a second. Here are two people who worked in presidential administrations. I would be interested to find out, and I'm very skeptical that I would have success in searching for an example of the following. If either of these people had expressed principled criticism of the arrogation of power by the president for whom they worked under, respectively, the Ford and Reagan administrations, I would warrant that neither one of them gave voice to concerns about the imperial presidency when they were employed in a Republican administration, and I don't recall hearing or reading anything by either of these gentlemen during the Bush administration. So once again, we're back to the old who-whom dichotomy. Who does what to whom? You want to be the pitcher rather than the catcher in that relationship. And the Republicans and Democrats are, in their separate ways, equally contemptible when playing that game. That being said, let's continue with this Jeremiad. Too many overreaching laws give the president too much discretion to make too many open-ended rules controlling too many aspects of our lives. There's no end to the harm an out-of-control president can do. I agree with that. I'd take that as an axiom. Bill Clinton lowered the culture, moral tone, and strength of the nation. Hold it just a second here. You're imputing way too much power to the president. Some might say Bill Clinton was a reflection of the degenerate moral tone and culture and strength of the United States. After all, he won two pretty resounding electoral victories. He was the popular choice in the second of those campaigns in 1996 when he went up against probably the least plausible Republican standard bearer since Woodrow Wilkie was paid by the FDR regime to throw the 1940 election, Bob Dole. I just can't stand the thought of Bob Dole. Here's a guy who famously said a few months before the 1996 election, I've got nowhere to go but the White House or home. And, of course, everybody thought he meant Kansas. Well, everybody who thought that Robert Dole was capable of sincerity, because after the election was over, he went to the Watergate Hotel in his natural environment, which was Washington, D.C., where he became a lobbyist on K Street. Interesting, as I'm reading this book, Imperial Cruise, I'm learning that K Street, at the turn of the 20th century, was notorious as a haunt of prostitutes. Well, that hasn't changed, except the prostitutes today, the corporate lobbyists, the political lobbyists, the retread politicians who can't make an honest living, they've managed somehow to bring prostitution into disrepute. But Bob Dole ended up becoming a lobbyist for the Chilean government. That's sort of interesting. I'm trying to figure out how that happened. But maybe the fact that Bill Clinton was popularly elected in 1996 and elected by a pretty impressive plurality in the three-way race in 1992 is a reflection of the culture. But I really bridle at the notion that the president, whoever he is some kind of a divine emperor king. That's not the way the position is supposed to function. We don't elect a political messiah. Granted, it's almost impossible now to talk about the presidency without metaphorically tugging on your forelock and expressing yourself in tones of chastened and awestruck reverence. This is something that people who are adept in image making and analyzing the efforts of people in image making call institutionalized awe. And quite frankly, this is something that has been cultivated by both parties pretty diligently since, well, let me think, Teddy Roosevelt. We talked about Teddy Roosevelt in an earlier segment. He was the most photographed president up until that time. He was very careful about sculpting his image. He refused to be photographed playing tennis because he'd have to wear frilly white things when he played tennis, and he thought that that would visually emasculate him. And so this former asthmatic with a nasal adenoidal voice, but I don't think he would have survived in the era of radio and television or even talking motion pictures because he had a voice that was thin and reedy and abrasive, not full and robust and stentorian as would befit somebody who's the exemplar of masculinity that he considered himself to be. And he was an impressive man, but he went out of his way to try to mold that image, somebody who was sort of the alpha male of America's culture. And once again, this essay seems to traffic in similar sentiments, and I can't stand it. Barack Obama, however, has pulled off the ultimate switcheroo. He's diminishing America from within so far successfully. He's not the first president to do that by any stretch of the imagination. Let's see. He may soon bankrupt us and replace our big merit-based capitalist economy with a small government-directed one of his own design. He is undermining our constitutional traditions. The rule of law and our Anglo-Saxon concepts of private property hang in the balance. Obama may be the most consequential president ever. The Wall Street Journal's steadfast Dorothy Rabinowitz wrote that Barack Obama is, quote, an alien in the White House. He is bullying and offenses against the economy and job creation are so outrageous that CEOs in the business roundtable finally mustered the courage to call him anti-business. That's important, of course, because the business roundtable supported the nationalization of the automobile industry or large portions thereof, and they supported the Obamacare monstrosity. Veteran Democrat Senator Max Baucus blurted out that Obama is engineering the biggest government-forced redistribution of income in history. Fear and uncertainty stalk the land like two giant stalking things. Sorry, I couldn't resist it. That's, of course, a tip of the hat to Blackadder. For those of you familiar with that program, the two authors of this piece had the discipline merely to use the cliche, fear and uncertainty stalk the land. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke says America's financial future is unusually uncertain. And that, of course, summons to my mind memories of Donald Rumsfeld talking about known unknowns and unknown unknowns. And once again, that's how people talk when they want to maintain the illusion that they know more than the rest of us when they don't. A Wall Street fear gauge predicted market volatility is flashing long-term panic. New data on the federal budget confirmed that record-setting deficits in the $1.4 trillion range are now endemic. Obama is building an imperium of public debt and crushing taxes, contrary to George Washington's wise farewell admonition, cherish public credit, use it as sparingly as possible, avoiding likewise the accumulation of debt. Bear in mind that towards the payment of debts there must be revenue, and that to have revenue there must be taxes, that no taxes can be devised which are not inconvenient and unpleasant. Opinion polls suggest that in November midterm elections, voters will replace the president Democratic majority in Congress with opposition Republicans. but that will not necessarily stop Obama. Do you see how these people are making valid points in the service of a fallacious solution? And they're also posing a false dilemma. The dilemma is not Obama versus freedom. Are we going to be ruled by Obama, or are we going to see Republican restoration of freedom? The dilemma has to do with the nature of this two-headed, bipartisan, unitary monstrosity that is establishment politics, of which these people are long-term practitioners. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397 is our call number. We'll be back in just a minute.
System memory crash.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
So according to Ernest S. Christian and Gary A. Robbins, writing in Investor's Business Daily for yesterday, the sum substance, the fons et origo of our distress as a country is the Obama administration. Apparently, this menace arose sua sponte, of its own volition, from a flat and featureless terrain. Suddenly, we were blindsided by the advent of this anomalous president who is, according to Dorothy Rabinowitz, quote, an alien in the White House. Now, by alien, I don't think she's suggesting that Mr. Obama is an extraterrestrial. Ironically enough, some of Mr. Obama's supporters have said things that would tend to support that idea, because they have compared Mr. Obama to the heroic and entirely commendable Mr. Spock, the second in command of the Starship Enterprise. And Obama has pronounced himself to be a Trekkie, which is something that I find commendable, albeit in a very limited sense, in Mr. Obama's personality. I also think he's got a very admirable jump shot. That pretty much exhausts the list of things I respect about Obama. Oh, wait a second. He's also apparently a very good husband and father. Let's not by any means deny that aspect of the man's personality. He appears to be, in terms of the management of his own household, a very good man. And he also has entirely admirable self-control, a quality which I frequently find failing in my own life and personality makeup. That being said, in terms of his politics, I think Mr. Obama is thoroughly collectivist. I think he's a disaster as a president. But referring to him as an alien is a really interesting characterization here. They want us to believe that he is something unique and uniquely unsavory in American politics. As far as I can tell, Mr. Obama is a more articulate, slightly better educated, slightly more agreeable version of the same president that we suffered under for 8 years between 2001 and 2009. Really, his administration thus far has been marked by continuity with the Bush regime rather than repudiation of it. And this takes me back once again to one of my favorite themes as illustrated in one of my favorite stories. I warned you I was probably going to be telling you some of the same stories I've barraged you with on previous occasions. In the build-up to the 2006 and then the 2008 elections, the former being a midterm election, the latter being a presidential election, in the Republican-aligned talk radio programs, I noticed that there was a common theme of being beaten to death. That was the danger of the powers being exercised by the Republican congressional majority in 2006 and the Republican president in 2008 falling into the wrong hands. The question was not whether there were any hands appropriate for the exercise of such distended and dangerous powers. The question was, will ours be the hands that deploy those powers, or will they be assets in the hands of our political adversaries? Once again, we're back to Lenin, who does what to whom. In spite of the fact that this essay makes some admirable points, it is still a variation on the theme of Lenin's great political dichotomy. Of President Obama intent on achieving his transformative goals, despite the disagreement of the American people, has powerful weapons within reach, continue the authors. In one hand, he will have a veto pen to stop a new Republican Congress from repealing Obamacare and the Dodd-Frank takeover of banks. In the other, he will have a fistful of executive orders, regulations, and Obama-made fiats that have the force of law. It's interesting. If you take a look at the use of executive orders, that's something that Clinton, of course, made notorious. Stroke of the pen, law of the land, kind of cool. So proclaimed the doliocephalic Clinton courtier Paul Begala, I believe in 1996 or 1997, as a way of dealing with Republican obstructionism, what most people would call checks and balances. What many would call obstructionism, I would call checks and balances. Most people would call it gridlock. I call it power being used to limit power, to paraphrase Madison. But if you take a look at what happened with George W. Bush from 2001 to 2009, suddenly you had signing states being used as if they were a form of legislation. Mr. Bush would sign an act into law, and then he would encumber it with dicta that would supposedly clarify and reinterpret what he had just signed in ways that he considered to be appropriate. That is not an option that is sustainable in constitutional terms, which is something that Mr. Bush did promiscuously on the advice of a fellow by the name of Samuel Alito. Samuel Alito was a Reagan administration functionary who first devised the notion that signing statements could make material changes in bills that were signed into law by a president. Mr. Alito was, of course, appointed to the Supreme Court by George W. Bush. That one policy suggestion alone, and the way that it bore awful fruit in the Bush administration, the administration of Bush 43, that is, that one policy alone makes Alito, in my opinion, far deadlier and far more dangerous than Ms. Kagan. Right now, of course, there's an attempt to induce a continent-spanning paroxysm of terrified outrage over the dread prospect of Elena Kagan being put on the Supreme Court. Don't like her. Don't have much respect for her, speaking in terms of her background and her affiliations. Don't think she's particularly bright. I don't think she's particularly accomplished. I don't like her philosophy at all. But quite frankly, after the job the Republicans have done in terms of selecting and appointing Supreme Court judges, Elena Kagan really is something that does not pose all that many horrors to me, the prospect of her on the court, given that the court right now is packed with people who are inclined to ratify and sustain the idea of imperial presidential power as long as it's a Republican who's occupying that office. To continue now with this Investor's Business Daily piece, under Dodd-Frank, let me back up a little bit. Under Obamacare, he can issue new rules and new regulations so insidiously powerful in their effect that higher-priced, lower-quality, and rationed health care will quickly become ingrained, leaving a permanent stain. That's true, and that's an outgrowth of something that was set in motion by Richard Nixon. He was the one under whose rule we ended up with the foundation for the HMO system, which is a form of corporatized medical care. It was basically the first real installment on the Obamacare design that started under a Republican administration. Under Dodd-Frank, he, that is Obama, and his agents will control all credit and financial transactions, rewarding friends and punishing opponents, discriminating on the basis of race, gender, and political affiliation. Credit and liquidity may be choked by bureaucracy and politics, and the economy will suffer. Well, the last thing we need to worry about, quite frankly, is the question of sufficient liquidity. But credit is being choked off right now because of what the Federal Reserve is doing. The Federal Reserve is choking off credit to credit-worthy small businesses because it's no longer imposing penalties on banks that refuse to lend. It's creating liquidity in Nowakian proportions. But it's not encouraging banks to lend to people who are credit-worthy in order to invest and make profit in the private sector and pay off their short-term credit, their short-term indebtedness. He, that is Obama, and the EPA may try to impose by regulatory fiats many parts of the cap and trade and other climate regulation, legislation, that failed in the Congress. That's true. Oh, it's too bad he has the EPA at his disposal. Now let me think. Where did the EPA come from? That's right. It was created by Richard Nixon. That's another legacy of Republican socialism. You know, you Republicans might want to reconsider the wisdom of creating these implements of government power that seem to fall into the hands of people you despise. You might want to re-examine the notion that any hands are the right hands to wield these powers. And by executive orders and the interim effect of an industry-wide boot on the neck policy, he can continue to diminish energy production in the United States. By the trick of letting current law tax rates expire, he can impose a $3.5 trillion 10-year tax increase that damages job-creating capital investment in an economy struggling to recover. And by failing to enforce the law and leaving America's borders open, he can continue to repopulate America with unfortunate illegals whose skill and education levels are low and whose political attitudes often are not congenial to American-style democracy. A wounded, rampaging president can do much damage, and like Caesar, the evil he does will live long after he leaves office, whenever that may be. The overgrown, unpruned power of the presidency to reward, punish, and intimidate may now be so overwhelming that his re-election in 2012 is already assured, Chicago style. Now, the point of this essay, once again, is to talk about the possibility of a second American Revolution. And it seems to me that the point they're making here is that whether or not Mr. Obama is reelected, something must be done to remove him. Am I reading that wrong? Well, I'll consider that and other questions on the other side of the break. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397 on the Liberty News Radio Network. We'll be back in just a minute. So these two Republican PR shills, that's pretty much the role they're playing here, whether that was their intent. Their names are Ernest S. Christian and Gary A. Robbins. Christian, an attorney, was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, Secretary of the Treasury in the Ford administration. Mr. Robbins, an economist, served in the Treasury Department of the Reagan administration. They're making the case that Obama, in terms of his threat to what remains of the American Republic, is sui generis. He might be the most consequential president ever. He is uniquely depraved when it comes to his lust for the imperial powers of the presidency. The damage he is doing is unprecedented, perhaps irreversible. There's a good chance from their analysis that the fix is already in for 2012, and that whether or not the United States electorate wants to be rid of Obama, Mr. Obama will be reelected through the machinations of Chicago-style vote rigging. Of course, Chicago is notorious for vote rigging. There is a quadrennial resurrection that occurs when the dead arise from their graves and go and vote for Democratic Cook County machine politicians. That happens every single election in Chicago. It's just to be expected that Chicago is a sinkhole of Sicilian-style corruption. Forgive me, when it comes to electoral politics, I'm of course referring to medieval Sicily. I'm not referring necessarily to organized crime, although heaven knows there's plenty of that in Chicago as well, although I'd far rather deal with private organized crime than the official government sanctioned variety. One of the best indications here that this piece from Investor's Business Daily yesterday is intended to be a Republican flavored assault on the other party for doing the same kind of things the Republicans have done is found in the conspicuous absence of one word. It doesn't occur anywhere in the article. This is a little like the Sherlock Holmes story, Blue Blaze, the proverbial dog that didn't bark. Here's the word that was not said, and that word is war. Nowhere in the course of this piece do they mention the role of war in aggrandizing the imperial presidency, or the fact that Mr. Obama, this alien in the White House, has continued the same policy of foreign entanglement that his much more consequential predecessor, George W. Bush, acting for and on behalf of Dick Cheney, quite frankly, pioneered with respect to the conflicts in Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia, and now Costa Rica. You have, about four dozen U.S. warships and support vessels anchored off Costa Rica. You have battalions of Marines building a huge base in Costa Rica. Costa Rica is the only country in the Western Hemisphere that does not have an army. It is by constitution, by national constitution, committed to non-intervention and peaceful resolution of disputes. It's a beautiful country. I know many people in Costa Rica. I've interviewed the former president of Costa Rica, Oscar Arias. I like him. There, I said it. I like a politician. I like Oscar Arias because he's somebody who believed in the peaceful settlement of disputes. I don't share his enthusiasm for multilateral institutions such as the OAS. I don't share his enthusiasm for the United Nations or for groups such as the Committee on, or forget what, the Committee on Global Governance? The Council on Global Governance. Council on Global Governance was the organization he belonged to at the time. So he and I part company with respect to globalist issues and things of that sort. But I respect the fact that he's somebody who believes in the peaceful settlement of disputes, unlike pretty much every other politician I can think of, including Barack Obama, who is indistinguishable from George W. Bush when it comes to matters of imperial foreign policy, detention without trial, summary execution by remote piloted drone of anybody, including U.S. citizens the president wants to be rid of, etc., etc., etc. Now, a smaller Republican whom I respect, James Madison, and I quoted this before, but I'm going to quote a relevant part of this famous warning from James Madison as it applies to this essay from Investors Business Daily. This, of course, is from Political Observations, published on April 20th, 1795. It's found in Letters and Other Writings of James Madison, Volume 4, page 491. It was published in 1865. Of all the enemies to public liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded because it comprises and develops the germ of every other. War is the parent of armies. From these proceed debts and taxes, and armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the domination of the few. That's the part that I always quote. Here's the part that's relevant to this discussion. In war, too, the discretionary power of the executive is extended. Its influence in dealing out honors, offices, and emoluments is multiplied. And all the means of seducing the minds are added to those of subduing the force of the people. The same malignant aspect in republicanism may be traced to the inequality of fortunes, or traced in the inequality of fortunes, and the opportunities of fraud growing out of a state of war and in the degeneracy of manners and of morals engendered by both. No nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. Let me go back and italicize and highlight a few other things from this that are once again immediately relevant in terms of what these people didn't say. In war, the discretionary power of the executive is extended. Its influence in dealing out offices, honors, and emoluments is multiplied. Just a couple of weeks ago, the Washington Post did a very useful, albeit incomplete, survey article in several parts of the national security state that was created under Bush and Cheney. Huge, sprawling, self-sustaining, metastasizing, impenetrable to outsiders. 1 million people with top security clearance? How many millions of people are employed by this monstrosity? No one knows. But this is something that erupted on the American scene during the Bush administration. It is larger, it is more expensive. It is several orders of magnitude worse in terms of its invasion of our liberties and the threats that it poses literally to the very lives of American citizens than anything Obama has done so far. Obamacare may well eclipse this. I'm not going to underestimate the capacity that Obamacare has for being a menace to life, liberty, property, and health if it doesn't entirely destroy what remains of our health care system here in the United States. I will be astonished and grateful. That's an evil which is still largely prospective, albeit one that is appreciably bigger than the proverbial cloud on the horizon the size of a man's hand, to use the biblical expression. The national security state created under Bush so far is the most consequential thing that's ever happened, and there's not a mention of it here. They could be indicting Obama's abuses of the rights protected by the Bill of Rights. They could be indicting Obama for countenancing torture for using his influence through the so-called Department of Justice to try to wipe the slate clean of accountability for the people who created supposed legal justifications for torture and carried out that policy. These are horrible things that Obama is doing, but these are things that are perfectly in harmony with what his predecessor did. And for reasons of partisan advantage, these two shills don't mention that element of what Obama has done. They don't mention the fact that Mr. Obama right now seems to be poised to attack Iran. And part of that's because one prospective 2012 Republican standard bearer, Newt Gingrich, oh, what a demented little rodent he is. Actually, forgive me, he's an amphibian. He's a moral amphibian, I suppose. Is saying that the problem here is not that we're bogged down in Iraq and in Afghanistan and Somalia and Yemen and elsewhere, but the problem is that we've not yet attacked Iran and North Korea. This is from the Huffington Post from a couple of days ago. Former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich twice called on the United States to attack North Korea and Iran Thursday because the United States has only attacked one out of three of the so-called Axis of Evil members by invading Iraq. He also claimed that Muslims are trying to install Sharia law on America and that the war on terror should have been a war on radical Islamists instead. Speaking at an American Enterprise Institute event yesterday, Gingrich compared not following through on President George W. Bush's Axis of Evil agenda with not fully engaging the Axis powers in World War II. If Franklin Roosevelt had done that in 1941, either the Japanese or the Germans would have won, Gingrich said, adding that Americans should overmatch the problem. On the reaction to Bush's declaration of an axis of evil, Gingrich blamed Democrats because Americans had not followed through on President Bush's words. Quote, I believe he was right, but in fact could not operationalize what he said. Oh, that's a nice little piece of jargon, operationalize. That is, there was an axis of evil, Iran, Iraq, North Korea. Well, we're one out of three. And people ought to think about that. Bush was right in January 2002, and by the way, virtually the entire Congress gave him a standing ovation when he said it, then why is it that the other two parts of the Axis of Evil are still visibly, cheerfully making nuclear weapons? And it's because we stood at the brink, looked over, and thought, too big a problem. In an interview with Newsmax, Gingrich said that the secular elites haven't taken seriously threats to America and that Elena Kagan has no real appreciation of the danger of Sharia because she welcomed Saudi money while serving as the dean of Harvard Law School. Wait a second. If you're going to start talking about people who are cheek by jowl with the Saudis, you got to talk about the Bush family, which once again is much more consequential than Elena Kagan, much more consequential than Obama. But once again, it goes back to the Leninist dichotomy. Right now, that gang is the who, and we're the whom. We want the polarity to shift. And once we're in power, we'll proceed to do pretty much the same kind of things they did, but we'll be doing it to the benefit of our buddies, just as James Madison warned. So ends hour two of Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call number. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes, and I hope to hear from you, so stick around.